who is a descendant or who is, let's say, a successor of Nebuchadnezzar. So here, this might help us a little bit. Let's look up ahead, and I wish I could give you a page number. I'm sorry, but this is in part 3. And it's a discussion of the structure of the book where you're going to see some dates. And if you want to go up there, I will also try to find it over here. See if I can put it up on the screen. So it helps us a little bit maybe to get these dates in our minds so that we can understand a bit about the chronology and how this is all working out. And I think I have it here. There we go. Okay. So we read chapter to chapter as we're going along through the book, and maybe not so conscious sometimes of where exactly we're talking about historically. Daniel chapter 1 happened in 605 BC. And remember, BC dates go backwards, right? Next year will be 2018. Well, for them, next year would be 2016, then 2015. That's not what they said at the time, but that's how we count it today. So Daniel chapter 1 is the earliest, happens in 605. Daniel chapter 2, 603, so it's like 2 years later. So let's put it in our terms. If Daniel chapter 1 happened in 2017, then Daniel chapter 2 is 2019. And then Daniel chapter 3 is happening in like 2022. Okay, and then when you get down to Daniel chapter 4, we're probably talking about something around maybe 30 years later. So we're talking about like 2050 or so. Okay, we're talking about a big stretch of time that's passed between Daniel chapter 3 and chapter 4. Did you get that? It's like, okay, if we start in 2017 with chapter 1, then chapter 3 is happening in 2022, and chapter 4 is happening something like 2050. Okay, this next section, what we're going to, where we get into chapter 5, is all the way down here, 539. So we've gone extensively further down to get down to that point. We're talking about another, what? That's another good 30 years. So we're talking about like 2000. We're up into like 2080 now. Okay, we're really way, way up in the future. So when you read Daniel chapter 1, 2, 3, 4, you kind of think of all these things happening within a couple of years of each other. But sometimes between one chapter and the next, you're skipping 30 years. Right? Daniel chapter 1, you ought to imagine Daniel, real young guy, like teenager, like he's in the youth group. Okay, and when you get to Daniel chapter 5, we're talking about real old guy. Like he's in the seniors group. Like he's maybe the oldest guy in the seniors group. Okay? We're talking about a lot of years have passed. Now, that kind of helps you when you think a little bit about Daniel chapter 5. Let's look at the chapter and let's see how this is going to develop as we go forward. Belshazzar the king makes a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles, and he was drinking wine before the 1,000. First question here, who is Belshazzar the king? Well, there was a day when Bible scholars read their unbelieving, isn't this irony? Sometimes Bible scholars that don't believe the Bible. Bible scholars that did not believe the Bible said, Belshazzar, oh brother, Daniel doesn't know his history. And the reason they said that is there's a view that I'll talk about later. I'll save this for later discussion. But there's a view, an unbelieving view, that Daniel is actually a book written after everything had happened, like 400 years later. And it was actually a fake book. It's kind of like if somebody says, they pull out a book out of their closet and they're like, look at this. This is from the time of George Washington. George Washington wrote it. Really? I found it in my closet. Somehow it ended up in my closet. But George Washington is the author. A lost book. You open it up and it predicts the election of George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama. And you're like, look, George Washington knew about all this stuff. And at that point you're like, yeah, I don't think George Washington wrote this book. I think you wrote it in your closet and tried to make it look old, right? So that's what these unbelieving Bible scholars say about the book of Daniel. And the reason they say that is because they cannot believe that God actually can prophesy the future. They cannot believe that when God told future events that God can do that. So their way of getting around this so that they don't have to accept the miraculous is to say that Daniel was actually written after all the events. Now, they used to have a lot of proofs. They would say, the problem is the book of Daniel has a lot of Greek words in it, and they said Greek wasn't used at the time of Daniel, and the book of Daniel has a lot of historical mistakes in it. For instance, Belshazzar, there was no Belshazzar. Daniel doesn't know his, or the guy who wrote Daniel several hundred years later doesn't know his history. And if he really knew his history, he would know that there was no Belshazzar. And that was kind of like the proof that Daniel was really a fake book. So then they did a little bit more digging, and they started pulling out some more rocks and translating them. And guess what? There's tons of records of Belshazzar. Tons of them. There definitely was a Belshazzar. This is one out of a lot of examples in the Bible where the agreement of all the historians used to be, that's a big mistake in the Bible. Then they dug a little deeper and they found out, no, actually the Bible was right and we had the wrong story. And if you look in this note, I just made some information, or note down here. There are 37 texts that people have found from during Nabonidus' reign that confirm Belshazzar. 37 different texts that they have subsequently found. Another example of this is the Hittites. The Hittites used to be someone, or a civilization that they mocked, and they would say, there were no Hittites, the Bible is all messed up, right? You can go to the British Museum today, and there's a whole section of the museum that is dedicated to the Hittites. And it's all of these rocks that they dug out of the ground demonstrating the Hittites. Okay, there's a lot of stuff like this. So this is a pretty good illustration of unbelieving scholars rejecting the truth and the Bible being right all along. When they dig a little further, they find out what was going on. A little bit about Belshazzar. Belshazzar is probably not a direct son of Nebuchadnezzar. He's probably at least two generations down. The word that's used later on here, it'll say Nebuchadnezzar, your father. Well, the word Hebrew, it's Ab or Aramaic. Father, grandfather, or predecessor, like in a position, it's all the same word. So you would say, use that same word, Ab, father. You would use that same word even if you were referring to, let's say, like a pastor of a church. The guy who pastored three guys before him would be his Ab, his predecessor as pastor. The guy who used to be the pastor before I was pastor, kind of thing. So that word is the way that that's used, and that's probably what's going on with Belshazzar. Whether he's related directly to Nebuchadnezzar or not, the word is legitimate the way that it's used. Another thing that is interesting to know about Belshazzar, he is reigning together with another guy named Nabonidus. So Nabonidus is king, and Belshazzar, they call it co-regent. He's kind of like the co-pilot. Well, he's like the co-king, okay? And he's ruling together with Nabonidus. Which makes sense if you've ever wondered or noticed this. At the end of the story, verse 29, they proclaim concerning him that he would become third ruler in the kingdom. Why third? Well, because Nabonidus, Belshazzar, Daniel. So you're right after the co-king, right? Belshazzar is the second guy, and he's going to make Daniel the third guy. And that's why it's third, not second. Okay? That explains one of the details that's in the chapter. Here's something else you need to know about the story. You have to know a little bit about the setting historically for what was happening. And here, this is partly from the biblical story, but actually I'm bringing in a lot of information from the historical record. This is stuff that is really kind of, if we can say, indisputable. I mean, nobody really argues with this. Unbeliever, believer, everybody recognizes this is the history of what happened. And it's the story of the fall of Babylon. Okay, if you're familiar with it or not, we'll go through it just real quickly, kind of give an idea of the story of Babylon. So the way that this is set up at the time, Babylon is a walled city, and historically it seems that Babylon was probably one of the biggest and most safe, if you want to say it that way, one of the most well-defended cities in the ancient world. They had a wall around the city that, at least what they thought, nobody could possibly get through. Okay? And they were confident. Nobody can break through this huge wall. In fact, in the middle of the city, you have another wall, and you have inside the middle of that another inner section of the city. So it's like double wall. Going through the entire city, you also have this river that passes through. And the river passing through comes all the way into the middle through a tunnel, and in the middle passes through and it keeps on going out the other side. Okay, so basically the way this works is you've got this huge double wall that everybody agrees nobody can get through. How do you solve that problem in the ancient world? Ancient warfare, you surround the city and you just starve them to death, right? Well, they're safe inside their wall, but they're going to get hungry and they're going to come out eventually. And you have other places that discuss that. In Isaiah 39, you have exactly that situation. So, a siege. You set up a siege around the city. Well, Babylon is set up so well, they have their own river. So, you're not going to run out of water because you've got your own river. They apparently had enough food stored up for something like 30 years, right? So they've got all kinds of food inside. They've got their own river. They've got a wall that nobody can get through. And 30 years is long enough, you know, if you want to set up a siege for 30 years, you're going to get old sitting outside the city, right? I mean, it's just, you're not going to do that. It's too long. 30 years, it's just not enough time in life. So they're good. They're good to go. Now, what has happened historically during this period of time is that Babylon has little by little started to lose its power. And another civilization or another group, the Medes and the Persians, decided to go together. Medes and the Persians working together to take over Babylon's territory. And little by little they have. Right before this time, there's a really significant battle. I'll talk about it here in the notes. I believe this is note number 5 if you wanted to look at that. But in the notes, I talk about a great battle that had happened where the Medes and the Persians had conquered Babylon. Really significant battle. Who was leading the armies in that battle? Nabonidus. So this guy who's in the city, he's Belshazzar. The main king, the first king, is Nabonidus. Nabonidus leaves Babylon to go out and have this great big battle with the Medes and the Persians. And while the main king is out with his big army, they're defeated. Word comes back to Babylon that the main army has been defeated and Nabonidus is on the run. The main king is trying to get away. Okay? And basically, Babylon is what is left. The city, all the territory pretty much has been eaten up by the Medes and the Persians. All of those armies have come in, and they have surrounded the city. So the last piece that you have to know about this picture is that you're surrounded on all sides. Oops, wrong one. You're surrounded on all sides by a massive army. And they are kind of under siege from this army, the Medes and the Persians. Okay? Everything else has been defeated. In that city, then, sits Belshazzar and his other lords and his other rulers. Why are you having a party when you're in that kind of condition? Why throw a big party when you're surrounded by the enemy army? Well, there's a couple of pieces of that. Again, this is where we're just trying to put things together. We're making some guesses or trying to get an idea. But I think there's some information that helps us a little bit. Why throw a party? For one thing, it's a way of saying, hey, listen, you guys are all worried. We're surrounded. You can climb up on the walls and look out and see the enemy army. You can see that Babylon, and we've lost all of our territory. It's just this city is all that's left. Stop worrying. We're okay. They may have surrounded us, but Babylon still has its old glory. Look at the city. We have massive walls. They're not coming through. We've got food. We've got water. We're fine. Right? What are you worried about? We got 30 years before we ran out of food. Quit worrying. Sit back. We'll have a party. We're fine. Don't be worried. There's another piece of this. And you notice the details that happen here starting in verse 2. Now Belshazzar commanded to bring the vessels of the gold and silver which Nebuchadnezzar, his predecessor, had brought out from the temple in Jerusalem. That should be an echo all the way back to chapter 1, verse 1 and 2. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar, first verses of the book, Nebuchadnezzar conquered Israel, conquered Judah, and he took the sacred vessels and he put them in the temple of his gods. Well, Nebuchadnezzar commands that they bring out those vessels so that the kings and his nobles and his wives and his concubines might drink from them. So they brought in the gold vessels which had been taken out from the temple, the house of God. His wives and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of silver and gold and bronze and iron and wood and stone. I think we know where the story goes, handwriting on the wall, the judgment, and so forth. I think my tendency, or maybe a mistake, I'd call it a mistake, might be to look at that and think it was sort of like almost like a magical, or like, what do you say, like you just did the wrong thing, right? When you drank out of those vessels, kind of like, well, remember the story of touching the ark and the guy falls down dead. When you drink out of the vessels, when you did that, that was like a special vessel or something. And when you drank that, then that's why the kingdom of Babylon fell, because you used that sacred vessel. Okay. Remember, though, that those vessels had been sitting in the temple of a false god now for like 40 years, right? So all those 40 years, actually longer than that, 56 years, all those 56 years that had been sitting in the temple, nothing happened then. So what's special about this? And I would suggest that part of the reason God brought judgment that day in such a harsh, direct way is because of the pride that is expressed by what they did. Notice the detail. It's not just, well, you drank from the sacred vessels. That's true. But they drank wine, and they praised the gods of gold and silver and bronze and iron and wood and stone. This is probably what's going on. Something along the lines that you've got all the attendants to Belshazzar. Belshazzar is a very wicked man. Okay, Belshazzar had not made many friends. Belshazzar is himself in kind of a position of weakness, that actually people were more loyal to Nabonidus than to him. And because of some wicked things he had done, he had really made some enemies among them. So he throws the party. And the expression of bringing out all these vessels is a way of saying, don't forget the glory of Babylon. In fact, let's remember all the great exploits we've had in the past. Think of like a trophy case. You know, let's say that you have a ball team and they get their trophies from like 10 years or 15 or 20 years or whatever. And so the school or the group that has the ball team, they set up a big trophy case. And inside the trophy case are all the trophies that it... So you walk in, wow, these guys have won this championship, that championship. And if you're discouraged or you run on a rough patch, you go over there and you look at all the championships that the team used to win back in the day. Okay? In the way of bringing out all these vessels, it's a way of expressing, remember the victories of Babylon. Not just that. The assumption is that for you to conquer a city or to conquer a country, it doesn't just mean we are stronger than them, but it actually means because we conquered them, our God is stronger than their God. Okay, you can see this if you go back to Isaiah 38 and 39. In that place where the Rabshakeh comes up to Jerusalem, and he stands outside the gate and he yells up to them, don't put your trust in Yahweh. And then he starts giving the list. Where are the gods of the... And he lists all the people that they had conquered. Where are the gods of the Jebusites and the Amorites? Where are their gods? We conquered them. So we're stronger than their God and their God and their God and their God and their God. And you're sitting up in your city saying, we're not worried, we trust in our God. Where are their gods? We beat them. Our gods are better than your gods. We're better than you and our gods are better than your God. Same thing actually happens, ironically, right in this event. Because we have a historical record right at this time of a general saying to his army as they're going in to fight the battle. Before they go in, he says to them, don't worry. Our gods are stronger than their gods. We'll win this battle because our gods will be the victor. So when Belshazzar decides to bring out all the vessels of the God of the Hebrews, let's drink wine from them. Why is he doing that? They didn't run out of clean dishes. He brings out all these vessels as a way of saying, look, we beat their God. We beat their God. We beat their God. Look at all the trophies we have. Our gods are stronger than their gods. Stop worrying. We'll be okay. But yeah, there's an army outside the walls, but we're fine for 30 years. And our gods are stronger than all the rest. And it's that blasphemy that really stands behind what Belshazzar has done. Now, let me make one link that also gives a little piece of information or helps us see this story in context. What did we just read talk about last hour? Talked about Daniel chapter 4, and we said the central concern or kind of the central issue of Daniel chapter 4 is what? Pride. And if I wanted to put that in one expression out of that chapter, I would say something like, those who are proud, he is able to abase. Those who are humble, he is able to exalt. Chapter 4 and chapter 5 have a really close relationship together. Because chapter 4 and chapter 5 are showing you two different reactions or two different results that come out of that kind of pride. Let's see the rest of the story. I stopped reading in verse 4, so let's pick up at verse 5. They drank from these sacred vessels. They praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. And verse 5, immediately there came out the fingers of a man's hand, writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the palm of the hand, which was the writing. Just a little note here as we go by. They have since dug up in Babylon. They have since dug up the king's palace. They went down to the throne room. They found the throne room. And guess what? The wall of the throne room is plastered. Anyway, it's kind of fascinating. Like, that's very likely the room and the wall where this happened, where this event happened. The king's countenance changed and his thoughts alarmed him. His hip joints gave away, his knees knocked together, and he called as loudly as he could to bring in interpreters. It makes sense that he would be afraid. For one thing, you just see the fingers of a man's hand writing on a wall. He's not going to be scared. For another thing, you know a little bit about what's going on. This is a scary time. You're surrounded by another army, right? And he is trying to bring together all of his counselors to support him because he's a little insecure himself. And in the middle of that, something writing on the wall. Call in all these people to interpret. All the wise men of Babylon can come in. Any man who can read aloud this writing and declare its interpretation will be clothed with purple and the chain of gold around his neck and will rule third in the kingdom. The purple and the chain of gold around his neck, what's that like? It's like a physical representation. This guy's the king. We might think of it like a crown or something. You know, you get the crown on your head. That's an expression that he's the king. So all the king's wise men came in, but they were not able to read the writing or make known the interpretation to the king. King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed. His countenance changed. His lords were perplexed. Verse 9 kind of leaves you with a sense of total chaos, right? They're all there. Nobody can interpret. He's upset. They're upset. And nobody knows what to do. Right? Total chaos. And into the middle of that, the queen, because of the words of the king and his nobles, entered the banquet hall. The queen answered and said, O king, live forever. You should not let your thoughts alarm you. Let your color not be changed. There is a noble man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy God. Can I pause here and say, doesn't this sound really familiar now? Like kind of getting old. Like how many times do they have to do this? Right, chapter 2, call the wise men. Nobody can interpret. Then Daniel can interpret. Great, chapter 4, I had a dream. Call the wise men. Oh, nobody can interpret. Where's Daniel? Ah, Daniel can interpret. Chapter 5, we're back at it. Can we just call Daniel at the beginning, skip all these other guys? Well, here's why. In the days of your predecessor, illumination and insight and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. King Nebuchadnezzar, your predecessor, made him chief of the magicians and the conjurers and the Chaldeans because the superior spirit, knowledge, and understanding to interpret dreams and visions, explain riddles, and untangle problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Let Daniel be called, and he will declare the interpretation. What's kind of interesting about this, when it says the queen, don't think Belshazzar's wife. You know, we kind of assume that. He's the king, she's the queen, right? Simple thing. She is probably one of the widows of Nebuchadnezzar, or maybe Nabonidus' wife. In other words, what you should imagine is Belshazzar is the younger king, and this is the old queen coming in, the old queen mother, who's been around for like 60 years. And she remembers because she was there. She was living through some of this. So she's one of the few people that's still around and remembers this stuff. And the irony of it that's so interesting, Daniel had been made chief of the magicians, astrologers, and Chaldeans, but with the passage of time and several kings, it sounds like Daniel has gotten old and Daniel has been forgotten. Daniel has sort of been set aside. And it's only somebody who's been around during that time who still remembers. There's this Daniel, he's the answer to your problem. Oh, the queen mother actually brings a little bit of order into the chaos that is happening in the throne room right now. So Daniel was brought in before the king. The king answered and said to Daniel, you are that Daniel. Do you see what I mean? It's this kind of sense of like, I think I heard one time about him. You are that Daniel from among the exiles of Judah, whom the king, my predecessor, brought in from Judah. I had heard about you. But the spirit of the gods is in you, and illumination and understanding and superior wisdom are found in you. All these wise men were brought before me, they were not able to declare the interpretation. But I myself, verse 16, have heard concerning you that you are able to give interpretations and untangled problems. So if you can do that, you'll receive these rewards. Purple, chain of gold, third in the kingdom. Daniel answered and said before the king, let your gifts be for you. Give your rewards to another. Nevertheless, the writing I will read aloud to the king, and the interpretation I will make known. You, O king, the Most High God, gave the kingdom and the greatness and the honor and the majesty to Nebuchadnezzar, your predecessor. Review of history. You've forgotten me. You've forgotten what came before now. You've forgotten all these things that happened. Let me help you out. God gave him greatness. Because of the greatness, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled. Whom he wished was dead, whom he wished stayed alive, whom he wished became exalted, whom he wished was humbled. But when his heart was exalted, and his spirit became strong to act proudly, he was cast down from the throne of his kingdom, and honor was removed from him. The review of history actually highlights this issue of pride and humbling, right? Like I said, chapter 4, chapter 5, they're a pair. And that's because he's reviewing this history, how God humbled Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was driven away from the sons of men. He became like a beast. He ate grass like an ox until he knew that the Most High God is ruler over the kingdoms of men and sets over it whomever he wishes. Yet you, his descendant Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart even though you knew all this. It's about pride and humility. You have not humbled your heart. Against the Lord of heaven you have exalted yourself. To exalt yourself is to exalt yourself against God. And you have brought the vessels of his house before you and praised the gods of silver, gold, and bronze, and iron, and wood, and stone. This is so beautiful. This is like Isaiah. Which do not see, and do not hear, and do not know, but the God who's in whose hand is your life, breath, and all your ways, him you have not glorified. How do you praise a rock while the God who gives you breath you ignore? It's very dramatic. Then here's the writing. The writing is inscribed, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. Now, there's some discussion about these words because these words are actually words that they should have known. Okay, this is Aramaic. And Aramaic was spoken in Babylon. So there was some kind of discussion among interpreters and stuff like that. Why can't they just interpret it themselves? In other words, it's not like it's another language. To me, you know, mene, mene, tekel, upharsin, what's that? It's Aramaic words. And that was their language. So why can't they understand that? And there's different theories about why, you know, maybe it was written up and down instead, or maybe the character, the writing was a different kind of thing. Here's what I think it's pretty simple. Basically, it would just be like if you saw a handwriting up on the word, on the wall, and it said, numbered, weighed, divided. And that's it. Numbered, weighed, you're driving down the road and you see a billboard. Numbered, weighed, divided. Okay. Right? That's what's going on. These words, that's what they mean. Numbered, weighed, divided. Now, I think if you're sitting and you're having a party on a night when you're surrounded by an enemy army and everything is kind of chaotic, and then the words go up, numbered, weighed, divided, I think I look at that and I say, I'm not sure what that's saying, but it doesn't sound very good. That's what I'm thinking. Right? But it makes sense that they don't understand. Now Daniel is going to interpret. Verse 26. This is the interpretation of the message. Mene, numbered. God has numbered your kingdom and completed it. Probably the idea there is something like the numbers, the hairs of our head are numbered. Or something even like the days of our lives are numbered. Teach us to number our days. Kind of idea. That God knows I have, you know, this many 1,432 days left in my life. And every day, okay, now 431, 430. God knows that number. So your kingdom is numbered. God has given a certain number of days, and it's gone down. 1,000, 400, 200, 100, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, today. That's the idea. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found lacking. Kind of like, okay, if you buy a certain, let's say, precious, you know, mineral, gold or something, and you weigh it, and it's supposed to be 10 pounds, and it's 3. Okay, something went wrong here. God has weighed, and you are not genuine. You are not the real thing. Perez means divided. Your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. The Medes and the Persians, they know this. Those are the guys around the city. So when you say the Medes and the Persians, it's not just like, who's that? Where do they live? Those are the guys outside your gates right now. And your kingdom has been given to them. And even the way that the verbs are set up, or the way that it's said, it's like done. God has numbered, and it's done. You have been weighed, you are lacking. Your kingdom has been divided. Done deal. As in, it's over. Then Belshazzar commanded, and they clothed Daniel with purple and a gold chain around his neck, proclaimed concerning him to be the third ruler in the kingdom. Now, the end of the chapter gives you this incredibly dramatic feeling. Verse 30, in that same night, Belshazzar the Chaldean king was slain. The story takes you all the way up to that point, and it tells you about Daniel's prophecy, your kingdom will be divided, will be given to another, and then it doesn't even bother explaining the battle. Why not? Details. I mean, if I was writing this story, then there's a dramatic story. Here's how it happened, let me tell you all the details. That night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. He's dead. The end. Let's move on. Darius the Mede received the kingdom at the age of 62. Next story. That's the way it feels. Let me tell you a little bit about the history, because you know, I'm curious about this stuff, and it's interesting to know. We know this from archaeology sources or historical records, very strongly agreed upon, very, very good records that we know about. That what happened here was the Medes and the Persians, you probably have heard this story, the Medes and the Persians are looking to get inside this city. How on earth are you going to get all the way into here? You can't. You're not going to get through the walls. You can't do a siege. There's no solution. There was a certain guy, he was actually Babylonian, and Belshazzar, because of just his depravity, had killed his son in a very wicked way. This guy who is a Babylonian kind of high up in the court, his son killed by Belshazzar, he turns against Belshazzar and he leaves Babylon and he goes over to the Medes and the Persians. And among the Medes and the Persians, he tells them, I can tell you how to take this city down. And they figure out, even to today, it's really amazing. Engineers are still amazed by this story. They went up further up in the river and they created a way, dig out a channel where they could channel the water for a certain period of time. You only had so long, but you could channel the water off into another direction, kind of pour it into this area until that filled up. And they blocked off the river, and it gave them enough time that the level of the river falls. And they go inside, there's a tunnel underneath, like I said. The level of the water is down enough that they can go underneath. We have records of the speech that the general gave to them before they went inside. And this is the general who says, our gods are stronger than their gods. The Medes and the Persians are saying, our gods are stronger than the Babylonian gods. And they go inside, underneath the wall, underneath the second wall, and they pop up right in the middle of the city, right next to the palace. This battle, when I say battle, it doesn't really say it right. Basically, nobody died in this battle, because they just popped up in the middle of the city and they said, hi, this is our city now. And people said, okay. And it turned over. I said almost nobody died. There was somebody who died that night. And this is also in the historical record. These Persian kings, because remember I said this Babylonian traitor, that Belshazzar had killed his son, because that guy had gone out and given them the secret of how to get into Babylon, they gave him the privilege of going straight into the palace and personally killing Belshazzar the king himself. And he went in, they killed the king, killed a few other people that were connected directly to him, and then city turns over, it's their city, life moves on. And the story that you have in Daniel chapter 5 gives you exactly that drama, but it focuses on this basic thing. That same night, Belshazzar the Chaldean king, dead. That same night, Darius the Mede received the kingdom, life moves on. Now, let me put that in a little bit of a biblical context. I want to ask this question. Why are Daniel chapter 4 and chapter 5 a pair, but why are they different? Start with this. This is kind of interesting. Think about Daniel chapter 4 and 5. Both men are really proud, right? Both stories are about pride. Both men think that they are above God's wrath. Both men are initially scared when God gives them a revelation, a warning. Remember Daniel 4, Nebuchadnezzar gets the dream. He's scared, but then he goes on for the next 12 months and he's proud anyway. Both men were humbled in a powerful way to demonstrate God's justice. But they're different. The outcome is completely different. Belshazzar dies, right? Nebuchadnezzar lives. Belshazzar never got a chance to repent. Think about that. We said God gave a revelation 12 months later. God gave him a year, and then for probably 7 years, he's crazy. Finally, he repents, and God restores him. So Nebuchadnezzar got all kinds of opportunity to repent. Belshazzar, by the time Daniel comes there, Daniel says, you're dead. Kingdom's over. It's finished. I mean, just that clear. That night, he's dead. So why then is Belshazzar never given a chance to repent? What's the difference between this? And I think the answer to that question is what we saw back earlier when we read this. He says specifically, verse 22, he gives the whole testimony of Nebuchadnezzar. Yet, verse 22, you have not humbled your heart even though you knew all of this. Here's the difference. Nebuchadnezzar is basically, let's just say, a pagan. Nebuchadnezzar knows nothing. Little by little, God is working on him, and God is directing him and pushing him. And little by little, Nebuchadnezzar is coming to faith. Belshazzar is a person who has heard the story of Nebuchadnezzar. He's heard what God did. He's heard about God's grace. He's heard about God's work. And when you reject that, even though you knew all of this, when you reject that, you already got your grace. You already got your chance. You say, why didn't Belshazzar have a chance? His whole life was a chance. He had plenty of opportunity. And when it comes to a certain point, there is a limit to God's grace. There is a limit to God's... Eventually, God says, I've told you. This is it. It's just done now. This is the end. But there's something more to it. One more piece that kind of explains what's going on here. And it's the thing that I read over quickly at the end of the story. So at the end of the story, Daniel tells him, your kingdom is numbered and completed it. You have been... done. Weighed in the balance isn't found lacking. Your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. It's over. Party's over. It's done. What is Belshazzar's response? What does he do in response to what Daniel just told him? It's over. You're dead. Your kingdom is finished. So Belshazzar's response, verse 29, is what? Daniel, thank you so much for this revelation. Good job. I will make you third in the kingdom. Now, from Daniel's standpoint, think a little bit about it. If you know that this kingdom is going to fall that day, why would you want to be third in the kingdom? That's like the worst position to be in. That's the last guy I want to be, is third in the kingdom that is dead, right? Third in the kingdom, what kingdom? This is over. Party is done. We're toast. I don't want to be third. I want to be like the janitor of a small, dying business on the outskirts of the city or something so they won't hurt me. Third in the kingdom, that's the last position I want. And why would it be any honor to be third in the kingdom of a kingdom that's done for? Unless Belshazzar doesn't really take Daniel's warning seriously. Unless Belshazzar's response to that is, oh, okay, numbered, got it. Weighed, oh, whatever. Divided, given to someone else, okay. At least we still got time. We got 20, 30 years. Let's party! And if Belshazzar's response to what Daniel just said to him is, thank you so much for the revelation. Let me make you third ruler in the kingdom so that you can reign together with me. What an honor. This is a deep expression of unbelief. He's not accepting what... Are you listening? Are you thinking? Hello? I just said you're dead. Fall on your knees and beg for mercy. Okay, but I'll make you third in the kingdom too. Total rejection of what he just heard. So Daniel chapter 5 ends up illustrating or defending or demonstrating to us the fact that there are two very different responses to a word from God. Daniel chapter 4, a person who repents will be forgiven and accepted. A person, Daniel chapter 5, number one, who has greater knowledge, and number two, who rejects the truth he's given. There's not really any chance for a person like that. It's done. It's finished. After we come back after lunch, we will continue with chapter 6. And I'll just say this before we go into chapter 6. Kind of interesting. Chapter 5 ends with verse 31. Darius the Mede received the kingdom at the age of 62. And it starts out, chapter 6, verse 1, it was pleasing to Darius to establish over the kingdom. So in chapter 7, or chapter 6, we want to imagine a new kingdom, new ruler, new court, new setting. A lot of stuff has changed in chapter 6 because now Darius has taken over. Completely different country. Different country than chapter 5. The Babylonians are done for. They're over. And now it's the Medes and the Persians, and we're starting over with a new group. So when we come back in after lunch, we'll look at chapter 6 and how God continues to show grace in chapter 6. I think striking to us should be that God continues to promote Daniel even through a change of governments, a new kingdom, a new place. God's still working with him. Okay. Should we lead in prayer? I can lead us in prayer for lunch if that's easiest. Okay. Well, let's pray and let's ask the Lord to bless our time together as we eat lunch together. Father, we thank you for this story. We thank you for what you did. We thank you that you're working in history, the change of kings and the flow of power, and that you've got a purpose that's bigger than all of that. I thank you that you show great mercy to the humble, And we pray that you would help us. We plead with you. Help us to view ourselves as we truly are under your mighty hand. That we would receive grace and not your justice like we just saw in this incredibly dramatic story. Pray also that you would bless our fellowship now. Pray that you give us strength through the things we eat and that we would be able to enjoy this afternoon the really great privilege of looking at Daniel chapter 6 and Daniel chapter 7. Pray that you would bring these things into our hearts and cause us to love them. We ask this all in your Son's name. Amen.